Good evening, everyone. It's hard, nice to be talking at the beginning of a new year. Somehow about this time with it getting dark early, I sort of feel like hibernating, and it seems like we're up like in the middle of the night talking like this. So I'm glad it's a small group, and you're going to ask me to talk about my trip. So I kept thinking we used to have like a slide projector, and I would love to somehow to do a show, and I was kind of envisioning trying to show pictures up there. So I'll have to try to describe what I went through. And I don't know how much of a Zen talk it'll be, but in a way it is kind of, for me it's part of a kind of inspiring transformation that's gone on my life, going on trips like this. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that as I go along. But before I start, and maybe I'll come back to this a little bit later, I don't know why I find this sort of funny, and maybe I shouldn't think it's funny. I should maybe be apologizing almost, but I know several people came up and asked me, "Thought, are you okay?" after my concluding remarks at the end of Sesshin last 2 weeks ago. I think I did the same thing last year. I'm fine. I don't know why I sometimes sound. I think maybe I'm just better at expressing how I've always felt. Maybe I always was sort of have my down moments or feel. But I'm as in love with my practice as I've ever been. It sucks at times, and I'm embarrassed about things in my life and my practice. And there's times where I'm just want to get out of the Zendo, and I don't want to do concluding remarks or whatever. But my whole life is just completely changed, and in a positive way that it's hard to really put into words exactly. In a way, I felt sort of funny talking about the trip, other than it's just sort of fun to talk about it. And I'll just tell you guys some of the just sort of the regular sort of details about it. But because I don't feel like it was as profound a sort of experience as my first time going up in the John Muir Trail. There was something about that. I think just the being alone for such a length of time that was just inducive to my mind slowing down. And the kind of intense walking. In a way, we didn't do a lot of walking on this trip. It was the part of the arduousness of it had to do with sitting around and not doing a lot, because you were dealing with such high altitudes, and they were very worried and they're very conscientious about keeping you from overexerting yourself, which is the main thing that will cause altitude. Well, you know, main thing is whether you're susceptible or not. Some people just get sick at altitude; they'll get headaches or they'll get worse conditions. But the main thing that tends to trigger it is overexerting yourself. That's why actually fit people are more likely to get altitude sickness than really unfit people. There's no correlation to your cardiopulmonary ability and whether you get altitude sickness. So we walked slowly. We took a lot of half days. So there wasn't that kind of intensity of walking for hour upon hour, you know, going 10 or 15 or 20 miles a day that was so powerful on the John Muir Trail. But it still somehow feels appropriate to talk about it in a way. I mean, partly it's an interesting thing. Gives us all a break from, you know, a regular real Dharma talk. Something light. And yet, I hope I can touch on it somehow. And I've got some quotes from an interesting article I read over the summer by a woman who walked on the PCT. But let me just talk about the trip a little bit, and maybe other things will come up as I go along. I mean, first off, for me, just traveling alone is kind of a, you know, I would have been intimidated to do that. I'm always just shocked and impressed and wondered whether he was sort of being a Mr. Magoo. But watching Shindo over the years go off, Mr. Magoo in the sense of you didn't realize what dangers you were in, so you got along fine. But like, you know, going to mainland China on his own, I can't imagine running around in mainland China by myself. I mean, there's like no English language. I mean, there aren't even Roman letters on anything. So going on a trip like that, just by itself, was sort of, for me, an exciting, kind of thrilling thing that I would not have done years ago. And then going to that place, going near, you're very close to where the Buddha was born, in the Khumbu region, which is the part of Nepal and eastern Nepal where Everest is the actual area where the Sherpas came from. When I first started doing this trip, I didn't, you know, years ago I was like, oh, I don't want to go to Everest. It's overrun with people. And there's other more forested, more beautiful places further west, like in Annapurna. But then when I thought about it, when it really came down to it, there was that one, the allure of Mount Everest, just because of my own kind of weird connection to mountain climbing in my mind and history of reading about it. And the fact that that's really where the Sherpas are. I mean, you'll find Sherpa porters working all over Nepal these days, but that really is a Sherpa country. And the Sherpa were actually Tibetans who moved over the Himalayas into what's now Nepal about 500 years ago and brought their Tibetan Buddhism with them. And the kind of reputation they have when you read about them, I certainly found with it, with our group, which was there were four people, tourists, me, a father and son from California, and an accountant from Manhattan, a woman, and 13 Sherpas, and that was all. We didn't have any other guides other than the Sherpas. And they really are this jovial, inspiring, kind, unbelievably hardy sort of people. It was just little teeny things, zipping up your zippers for you, and I got a bad head cold just after we got up to Mount Everest, and they were putting me in hot, they're doing hot water things with, like, you know, menthol or whatever it is in the hot water, and they were called it a Sherpa sauna, and they were coming around and putting towels over me and just kind of massaging me and babying me, and there was just, I don't know, just a kind of inspirational quality about these people. And when you get to know them, you realize what really hard lives they have. They're working for no money. Halfway near the end of the trip, we realized that the leader, who started as a porter carrying lumber and stuff like that in those baskets where they tie a thing around their neck, we saw a lot of that. They were moving lumber. They don't allow you to cut and move lumber much of the year anymore because of deforestation, but at the time you could. So you saw lumber, you saw all these building materials, I mean, big stacks of must have been about 3 foot by 6 foot stacks of plywood, and men, little men, carrying them on their backs on these rocky trails. And he started that way, and he's moved up. He learned English on trekking, and he's now been a trekking guide. He's worked for REI for 30 years. His house fell down, completely wiped out in the earthquake. And you never got any sense of them feeling sorry for themselves. And when funny things would happen, like they would fall, drop something, or drop their clothes in a creek once, they start laughing. Their instant reaction is to kind of laugh at misfortune, you know, which is, it was sort of infectious. Anyways, the Khumbu region is where they're from, and there's, you know, Tibetan monasteries around there. So that really drove me to go there, despite the fact that it is really overrun with people. We were lucky to be there at late in the season. I can't imagine. There's every 500 meters, it seemed like, to a kilometer, there's a set of tea houses with little restaurants for every mile you walk up to and through these various little villages up to the base of Everest. And there's cell phone coverage the whole way. My cell phone wasn't working when I got to Kathmandu for some reason, so I just left it on airplane mode. Later, when I got back, I turned it on, it was working, and I was sort of glad I didn't realize that because it was nice to be out of communication for a while I was up in the high country. Getting into Kathmandu, it's just, I suppose, a kind of a little taste of what people experience when they go to India. I mean, it is just sort of overwhelming, the crush of people. And, you know, people with body parts missing, and people look like they could just drop dead right there in the street, and everyone wearing masks because the air is just completely, I mean, it seemed worse than anything we experienced in China. I guess maybe things in China are even worse now from what you hear, but you wanted to wear a mask. It smelled of burning everything. They're burning trash, they're burning dung, burning plastic. A complete chaos in the streets. I mean, it's a weird dance, and it's a testament to, I suppose, the human ability to, as a group, almost like you think about those birds that fly in the sky and they do these elaborate maneuvers. We have that kind of ability in us, apparently, because you watch people. There are no road rules. There are no traffic signals. There are pedestrians, bicycles, cars, and trucks going all around each other. And, I mean, they're driving English style, but there isn't really a road divider, so there's a very liberal definition of what's on one side of the road and the other. And regularly, you're in a car or a bus that starts accelerating at somebody who's walking into the path, and then they just sort of magically miss each other. I suppose there must be a lot more accidents on average than here, but I don't know. You know, maybe they're actually, because it's such an intense environment, maybe they all pay more attention than we do. We're kind of half asleep. And you just had the sense of the overwhelming poverty. The city isn't as bad as you would think from the news media. I mean, lots of old buildings survived all over the place, though hundreds of them were stuck, had lumber, often just in the middle of the road. If it was on a small street, they just have big, like, you know, 4-inch by 4-inch beams that were 15 feet long, pressing up against the building every few feet and just stuck down in the middle of the road, and cars kind of going around them and under them and people walking around. Sometimes you couldn't drive down the street because there was, just to keep the building from falling down. And a lot of people are living in buildings that are on the verge of falling down because they don't have any choice. It's weird that people, in a way, the people who are out of their home and the building fell down are almost better off because the government will slowly replace and are rebuilding buildings all over the place. But those people, it's not clear what's going to happen. You know, will they? No one's making them tear the building. There's no one out red tagging the buildings. Obviously, a lot of buildings are really unsafe. But on the other hand, there's a lot of stuff that didn't fall down. But still, I said this to everybody I've talked to about this trip, that just the drive from the airport to the hotel, it was like, it made me think of Mexico looks like Switzerland or something. I mean, in terms of being clean and organized and relatively wealthy, it's amazing people live there and live that way. The trip, we flew from there. That was one thing that I was really worried about. You fly, I don't know, really worried about it, but I'd wondered, you know, that there would have been a time in my life when it would have been terrifying because I'm not very good with heights. And in small, I don't mind big airplanes, but small airplanes I wasn't sure about. You fly to this place called Lukla, in an airport that the famous mountain climber, you know, Hillary, who they all love. It's interesting. They all love Hillary, and they all hate the Sherpas. All hate the Sherpa guy, the Tenzin. Wherever we saw monuments, they'd scraped his name off of it. He never really went back. He became an Indian citizen and was put on a government salary in India and was sort of a celebrity in India. But Hillary spent the rest of his life raising all these. Everywhere you went, there's a Hillary school, and you know, this airport we flew to, all this stuff was fundraising he did. He fundraised for the rest of his life to help people in Khumbu and in Nepal in general. We flew to this airport that he pioneered and had built, which is on the way and cuts the walking down a few days from extra walking from Kathmandu. It's at about 10,000 feet, and I'd first seen it on a History Channel thing, which was ranked the 10 most dangerous commercial airports in the world, and it's 110 feet lower on the lower side of the runway than the other side, so it's really quite a steep hill. It's only about 1,600 feet long. But that's actually an advantage because then you land going uphill, so it slows you down, and then you take off going downhill, and it's too short a runway for the planes they use. If it were on normal ground, of course, it's just a wall at the end. You can't overshoot the runway, and there's a cliff at the other end. And the real danger is getting over this high ridge. You have to go up very high to get over it, and it gets clouded over. And we bounced around a lot, and the Sherpa guy was saying, oh, that's nothing, that you just sometimes are just diving up and down, and everyone's screaming and chanting, Om Mani Padme Om over and over again. And there's, you know, that which you counter that everywhere. We always walk on the right side of around all the little Mani walls, the little walls. Are they called Mani walls? People have carved Om Mani Padme Om or other things onto stone slabs that look like, you know, the Ten Commandments. And then there's just walls of them, as well as boulders and other markers like that. And bells you can spin. And you always walk around you keep your right shoulder to it, so you're going around kind of clockwise. And they'll get stuck where they can't go over. They'll get where they have to go around in circles because they can't see the ridge. And that's where it gets dangerous because they only can do that for so long. And then if it's clouded out, you know, and it just can cloud over either the runways. And there's the other one. There's no way to land really safely with clouds. So you just take your chances, and they go early in the morning. But it was fine. It was fun. It wasn't scary at all. The landing just seemed kind of easy. And then we just started walking. And it was several days. At first, you're in the forested, deep river valley that's beautiful, with very high bridges. I walked over a 110 meter high bridge that was steel, but it was like open grates, and it swung in the breeze and had beautiful prayer flags hanging all over it. And I could really see the effect of my practice there, because I do have a lot of fear of heights. It's variable in the way it comes up. And I was feeling okay, but I decided I wasn't going to look down. But it was so vivid that I could just walk and look at the people in front of me and not go there in my mind about where I was or think about the bridge collapsing under me or wondering about, you notice occasionally there's nuts missing out of things on them. And they're big bridges. I mean, pack animals walk over them and all that. So this was a relatively new one. There was an old one right under us, too, so that made it even felt better. It was a relatively new bridge. The Swiss, I think they're all Swiss companies built these things for the Nepalese government. But I could see that. It was very vivid that I could just pay attention to what I was doing and really choose not to start thinking about where I was and just walk, but just face forward and just, you know, just be there in my body walking and not going off and thinking where I was. When I came back over the bridge at the end of the trip, I made a point of not only looking down, but even looking over the edge, you know, because I was feeling pretty good, and I didn't really feel particularly frightened or uncomfortable up there. And after a couple of days, you go up a steep climb, and you come around a hill, and oh my God, there's this town. It's there called Namche Bazaar, which is their main, the biggest town in Khumbu, and it's been occupied since the Sherpas came to the area about 500 years ago. And it's just like a horseshoe-shaped side of a hill with steep buildings, you know, one on top of the other, going back up a steep hill, just smack on the side of a hill that goes on up and disappears. And it's just so medieval, and of course you go in through there's like a stupa right when you come in, and kind of a Buddhist-like gate with paintings on the top, Tonka-like paintings on the top, and it was all cloudy, and yet it's sort of international. I mean, there's knockoff shops where you can buy, everybody, everywhere in Kathmandu, wherever you go, they're all wearing parkas that say North Face, Mountain Hardware, and it's all fake, you know. So I bought some of my very own fake, I got an authentic fake North Face shirt and hat, but for like $3. You can tell when the down ones are because the guys take off their down jackets and there's what looks like chicken feathers stuck all over them. And even when the jackets are years old, they're still just shedding feathers that don't look like down really. But I guess it keeps them warmer. Spent two nights there and had a magical experience because it was all dark and you couldn't see this big high, first real high. And that's the thing that's impressive. A lot of what you're seeing there isn't the prettiest mountains I've ever seen. You very quickly, after that town, we're all above timberline. This time of the year, it's been dry long enough that everything's brown. And the hills, in bright sunny days, it would almost look like you were in the hills around Southern California, with shorter grass, and then add in like these giant crystalline rocky peaks that look like someone's like put icing on them. I mean, the ice just does not look like them. It's just so stuck to the side of the mountain and so pure white. And that's what's sort of spectacular. And but the landscape isn't super pretty. It's just sort of, once you get up higher, it's just this kind of vast, desolate, awe-inspiring environment. But it's on a huge scale. It's a completely different thing than I've seen in the Sierras. But I wouldn't call it pretty, really. Lower down, we come back through a forest where there's these, it was deciduous. So again, a lot of the trees had dropped their leaves. You can see that must be lush and beautiful. But the first night was magical, and there was that huge face there, but it was all cloudy when we came in. And in the middle of the night, the clouds had cleared up, and it was a moonless night, and I looked out my window, and you could see it in detail, just from like starlight, I guess. There was so much ice, and it's so white. It's very vivid in the sky, which is weird, you know, on a moonless night to see a mountain up in the air like that. Even on nights when the moons were out, the few times I saw the stars, usually it was too cold. It was just freezing cold, and we were either in tents or indoors. And indoors meant the glass would be completely covered with ice, so you didn't see the sky a lot. But the few times I was out in the middle of the night, even when the moon was out, it was the brightest stars I've ever seen. I mean, it was just so up that high. It was so clear. Anyways, we walked from there. We got to our first view of Everest. And along the way, we stopped and spent several days. In a way, the challenges of this trip, there's lots of discomforts. There was very strange food, American-ish food that they served us. The bathrooms are challenging. You know, they were all squatting toilets without any flushing mechanisms. Sometimes they were just holes and very smelly. And I'm lucky I can actually squat completely down to where my, you know, my butt's basically on the floor. It doesn't hurt my quads at all, because having to kind of bend your knees to 90 degrees and hover there in the air is a lot more challenging, I can imagine. And it, once we got up high, it was all sub-zero, I mean sub-zero Celsius, sub, you know, freezing at night. And you just pour, they give you pitchers of water to pour down the toilet. So there's water all over those porcelain toilets, when they were porcelain, that would then be frozen ice. So you had to kind of hover over frozen ice in the night. The people in Trip are inspiring. This one woman is an executive, a workaholic, but she does, like, runs Ironman. She'd never done any hiking in her life. She had the same problem I did. She couldn't get her doctor to sign the note to go. She had to go shopping for doctors to sign the note, for just because her legs used to were swelling up a little bit on airplane flights. She was doing this just because she's training to do a 135-mile race across the foot race across the Sahara Desert next year, and she thought this would be good training. You know, she wanted to get away from work and not run. So. And then an older man who was with his son, who was doing doing his sort of bucket list kind of things. He'd been to Kilimanjaro. He'd just come back from Antarctica. But fun, comfortable people to be with. And even that's sort of odd for me. It's just spending that much time with people I didn't know. And, you know, another thing that is just, I don't know why this is kind of a non sequitur, but it's something Ento was struck with going there. I didn't know much about this trip. I just sort of went. Wasn't sure what to expect, and there's something about that feeling of just going and kind of doing whatever you do each day, and not having a lot of expectations one way or the other about it being fun or beautiful or not. I was excited, but I don't know. I wasn't thinking a lot about before I went. I wasn't sure what to expect, and I have no. And when I think about it now, it's completely different than what I've expected in so many ways. Just visually, what it looked like, what the hiking was like. Well, after several days, you get up there, and it's you can see, and this is sort of a sad part of it, and I think there's other parts of Nepal that are less impacted by people. There's no sense of wilderness, and what there is a lot of is the human destruction of the landscape. The deforestation is rampant. All these areas had right up to that Namche, there were small trees. You're kind of at a, you know, it's not quite completely above timberline. It's that sort of sub-timber, alpine, sub-alpine area, but the forests are all gone. They are replanting them in places. There's a big project to replant forests. But there's also been, along with deforestation, there's been overgrazing of stock animals. And what's that led to is just terrible erosion. It's just these areas, and it's very obvious where a side of a mountain is just collapsed. And it leaves a very ugly kind of scar. It looks like those pictures of the kind of mining they used to do in California where they would just hose the side of the mountains down. It's very distinct, and you see that everywhere, right up to the edge of Everest, practically. It is cleaner than I guess it used to be. There isn't trash everywhere. And, you know, in a way, there's not a lot else to say about the trip. We got up to the mountain and walked up on the glacier, which was interesting. Where the base camp is, surprisingly, is actually on a glacier. I never seen so many, read so many books about it, and seen so many pictures. I never realized you're actually just on a glacier, and there's just a very thin layer of rubble and dirt and rocks over it on the kind of the horizontal surfaces you can walk around. You can't actually see the top of Mount Everest there. You're at the edge of this long ice fall that goes up a long valley to and around a corner up to there. And I got sick, and that was another kind of, in a way, to me it was part of the adventure in a weird sort of way. I woke up with a terrible head cold, really bad, just, you know, terrible, blowing my nose all the time, and felt like kind of cold where, you know, you wouldn't be fun to stay home in bed even, you felt that bad. Maybe it was, and I probably was feeling a lot worse because I was up, you know, in such thin air. I actually discovered I couldn't, and maybe it was partly the cold. It wasn't in my chest at all, thank God. That would be miserable to have had it. I mean, I don't know what would have happened. They might have been carrying me down or calling for the helicopter. But it was weird going to sleep. As you go to sleep, you relax and you don't breathe quite as deeply. You know, your breathing gets a little more shallow. And I've been very aware of that fact from having cats on my chest. and falling asleep with a cat, and you go, because you feel like the extra little extra weight of them, and the fact that you don't breathe quite as hard, you'll feel like you're strangling a little bit. I started realizing that's how I felt falling asleep laying on my back at high altitude. I had to lay on my side and not be fighting gravity to be able to breathe enough because the air was so thin. And you really did feel it. I'm blown away by these people that climb up these mountains, because we spent 10 days or more very slowly, methodically acclimatizing. We took the drugs, the Diamox for it, and even the woman who does Ironman and is 39 years old, I mean, she just had no get up and go once it was uphill. I mean, if you're walking downhill or on flat ground, you could move more or less normally. But the minute you had any incline at all, it was like you were just, you know, you had no energy. But having being sick, that was interesting. What I thought was the highlight of the trip was there was one more higher hike. I missed a chance to go up another, I don't know, what was that, 500 feet, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it got you over 18,000. It took you to 18,200 feet to this, it's not really a peak, it's sort of a high point of a ridge you can walk up more or less. And you have a good view of Everest up from up there called Kolhapur. And that's what I thought was a highlight. I actually thought that would be more of a highlight than going to Everest Base Camp. But I felt pretty good getting to Everest Base Camp. And I knew, woke up that day and like, no way. You know, it was as it was a 5-hour walk down the hill to where we were all going later that day. And that seemed like enough. My legs felt like spaghetti. And they just sent me later in the day, like at 8 in the morning. They all got up at 5 in the morning and went off with headlamps on and, you know, in teens, high teens, weather outside up there. And they all said it was a very hard, hard hike. But I didn't feel at all disappointed. I don't know. And then several days of dealing with really cold. And we ended up spending more time in inns, but the inns were almost as cold. The temperature really was almost the same inside as outside. They're just rough stones. And it's funny, the older buildings you'd see, they all had plaster or you know, whatever it is you put it in between the bricks on the building, a mortar. But all these new brick stone buildings and rough, very rough cut stone, like you could stick your fingers in between, there holes big enough for your fingers to go, had no mortar or plaster. And the inside was like an 1/8-inch thick paneling of just plywood. And then there were gaps in the plywood where there would be no like wood over the gap. So you could always, when the wind started blowing, you could put your hand up to any of the gaps and just feel the wind blowing. And the temperature was really not much. Your body would heat the room up some, but I mean, it was really cold. It was cold all the time. And there was the one room where they would feed you, and depending on, there was not a lot of people in these inns, so they were reluctant to use the shit they had. And I mean, literally, the yak dung, which is what they were burning a lot in these little stoves, a little potbelly stove in the kind of joint eating room area. Sometimes they would turn them on for a while. One night we were going up, and the woman, they ignite it with kerosene. She spilled a bucket of kerosene over the floor. There's kind of a metal raised surface that the thing sits on. And they decided to burn off, they cleaned it up a little, and they decided to burn it off the rest of it, basically gasoline. So there's this big flame of gasoline kind of going about that wide, this tall in the room, and all the windows are closed. And I'm sitting there thinking, we're watching, and this is going on and on. I'm like, I'm hoping they're going to open the windows. This can't be good to be breathing all this in here. Eventually, they did think about opening the windows. I got up and left because it was getting like dizzy feeling with this all this stuff, and you were kind of wondered what was going to happen next. That place, I was in a tent outside, just me and the woman, the father and son team. When they saw how small the tents were, they started staying in the inns. We were always camping right next to an inn, basically in the yard of an inn. So your tent was always like 5 feet from a window where you could rent a bed for $15, a room for $15 a night. And they just dug a little hole that I swear to God, it was 6 inches deep at most, and that wide, and like that long, and they had this weird little medieval, little tall, narrow little pup tent, and then like something out of a hospital, you know, like a toilet seat chair. You were very intimate with your fellow travelers on that. Me, her, and the Sherpas were all using that tent that night. Got a good view of the stars though because of that. Coming down, being cold and sick though, and somehow that I kind of appreciated that. There was that part of me that it would normally be rebelling against it, and I was, and maybe feeling sorry for myself, but I just kind of didn't go there a lot. You just kind of got through each day. I worried, you know, it was like, what if I get sicker the next day, and there was some big hiking, and I even had a little teeny bit of turista there on the last day, just to kind of rub it in. When we got back to this town, by the time we finally got back to the airport, our place, and flew down, I was all better and adventures in Kathmandu. What time is it? I feel like there's something more I'd like to say about it, but to me, I don't know. I still can't get over this magic feeling of doing stuff like this and being able to do it. I heard through the grapevine that Nyogen was mentioned me in one of the talks in Rahatsu. And about wonder saying, you know, does he appreciate that he wouldn't be doing all this stuff if it weren't for practice? And that is so vivid in my mind, that the practice, it's made life an adventure in a way that, for me, I was always kind of, you know, uncomfortable. It's interesting, travel. I used to not like travel very much. So many trips I've did, and I can think in my 20s and 30s, I was uncomfortable, and they never kind of lived up to anything. And I could see how this trip might have been, it wasn't as beautiful as I expected it in some ways. You're uncomfortable a lot of the time, which is sort of the fun of it now, in a way. The father and son team actually took a shower, which the Sherpas were upset. They didn't want us to take a shower, even where there was hot showers, which there were almost none of, because they have a massive fuel shortage there. The Indians have shut down the border to fuel imports because India is in a dispute with Nepal, and building materials. A lot of reconstruction shut down from the earthquake because India is mad at them over sort of internal political issues. But there's very little fuel. There's very little natural gas, propane. They shut the lights off in Kathmandu on a regular basis, and you know when their lights are going to go off in your area. Like, the hotel had it posted, told you when not to get in the elevator. So there wasn't, and he actually got in that cold water. I mean, nearly, you know, 32 degree water in a room that, I mean, it was warm if it was in the 50s in our room. So, I don't know. I wish I could express it better. I mean, I over and over again pinch myself with the sense of how life has become like an adventure. With traveling, though, I guess that I didn't quite finish my thought there. That the expectation thing. I was excited about it, but I don't think I had the kind of expectations before. I mean, it was like life was always sort of disappointing to me in the past, and now it's kind of whatever it is, and you kind of appreciate it for what it is. I enjoyed, once we got to the top and there was no more, once we started walking down, it was even almost better. There was another 5 days of walking, almost a week with these people. It was 6 days, but we were on the trip for another 7 days. So you got to the top and then you walk back. And that wasn't depressing or boring. In a way, it was sort of nice not to have anything to look forward to. You were just out in this environment every day, walking, hoping that I wasn't getting any sicker, and enjoying the environment. We did see, we did see two beautiful Buddhist monasteries, but there's not a lot I can say about them that's very interesting, other than show you pictures. They did have a hand and a head of a Yeti. We weren't allowed to take pictures of the hand and the head of the Yeti, but... we did in Kathmandu, they took us to a place where they paint tonkas, authentic tonkas. And they're trained, you know, craftsmen, young people being trained to do them. So I don't know what authentic means. You know, they're not monks doing it, but they're beautiful tonkas, and they're very enthusiastically sat there and talked about them. And it was wild. I've never really listened to someone talk about them, but there's the wheel of life, one, I guess, is what they often call it. And it's full. It's all these symbolic representations of these very abstract Buddhist concepts that you read about if you read kind of that Indian, very technical thing. And the one thing that really jumped out of my mind was pictures of the 12 links of interdependent origination, which, if you read like Indian Buddhist philosophy books, there's just very abstract concepts about, like, it's like reading a psychiatry textbook or something about the mind and the world and how these things interact. But they're all little pictures. So like contact was like a man and woman having sex, and I don't know. It was sweet, and he was so enthusiastic, and it was sort of inspiring. I bought one. I don't know what to do with it now. It's not been mounted, but anyways, what I'm going to close with, before I let you ask me any questions, unless I think of anything else to bore you guys with. I don't know. I read this article. And I just thought of it today, sitting. I went and had an acupuncture. I injured my rotator cuff, this classic area here in your shoulder where there's tendons going through a narrow opening. I've had it mildly sore in the past, and this is probably the worst one I've ever had. I did it asleep in my sleeping bag on about day four of the trip. It woke me up in the pain, and all I can figure is I was pushing up like this, which even doing that on my good arm, you feel this stress there. I really got it sore, so I've been having a little bit of acupuncture done on it. And, you know, I talked 2 years ago about the trip in walking, and I still feel like there's something about it that it's hard to really describe. And I saw this article, this was in The Guardian last summer. The title was 2,660 Miles Across the Wilderness. Long distance hiking is nature's great equalizer. And it was an American woman. Through hiking is monumentally hard for everyone, but humans are uniquely designed to excel at walking long distances. And this young woman, whose name was Carrot, I guess that must be her trail name, Carrot Kin, found out that a woman is every bit as good as a man. Let me just read a little bit of it, because there's just a couple little things that really jumped out at me. It's subtle, but it's the kind of thing that really made my eyes open up. Just let me read it. It's about three paragraphs in, but just so you get the sense of where this comes out of. This is the beginning of her little article about walking. The Pacific Crest Trail, as you know, is that trail that goes from Mexico to Canada. The John Muir Trail that I went on is a little teeny piece of that, but... And several hundred people every year in April set out to try to walk to Canada on that, and it kind of follows the crest of the mountains, the Sierras and the Cascades from one end to the other. And it's just because it's on the mountains, it's long, over 2,600 miles. Before I decided to walk from Mexico to Canada on the 2,660-mile Pacific Crest Trail, I had never done anything really physical in my life. I had never been an athlete. I had never played sports. As a child, I liked books. Frolicking in alone in the woods, and was terrified of anything involving a ball. As an adult, I learned that exercise helped my anxiety, so I lackadaisically took up jogging about 2 miles at a stretch. The rest of the time, I was, like most Americans, sedentary. When I first discovered through hiking, I didn't see it as an athletic endeavor so much as a Lord of the Rings-style adventure. Carrying my home on my back, walking across mountain ranges, making friends with other ragged characters on their own personal quests, facing down storms, hunger, loneliness, and whatever else might befall me. Emerging at the Canadian border, bedraggled and changed, the hero's journey. Part of me knew that in order to make it to Canada before the snow flew, I would have to average 18 miles a day, which was more than I'd ever hiked at once. But that detail seemed besides the point. So I quit my life and set out into the desert, as one does. I carried few possessions. I gathered water from springs. I slept on the ground. I had no home, except that I did. After a few weeks, I realized that I was living for the first time in my body. For the first months in the Pacific Crest Trail was painful. On day three, I developed Achilles tendonitis. I had to learn how to deal with that, how to tape it, stretch it, how to hack the back part off of my trail runners to give my Achilles tendon more room. There were people around everywhere to help me, other hikers with experiences and knowledge. I also had blisters on the, and she goes on, talks about treating blisters. I was walking, and then one morning, sitting on the floor of the shower in my motel room in the town of Mojave, after fighting my way alone through hurricane-force winds for 3 days, I looked at my overly tanned, scratched-up calves and realized they were no longer made of flesh, but had turned to wood. I was walking 25 miles a day, every day. I was pushing myself about 500 times harder physically than I ever had in my life. The entire rhythm of each day now revolved around my body, how much I could expect from it, what it needed from me in return. I had set out to walk from Mexico to Canada just for the sake of adventure, and in the process I had become an athlete. I've never thought of humans as being very physically strong as far as the animal kingdom goes. We can't sprint like a cheetah, climb like our primate friends, destroy stuff like rhinoceroses, or even fly, which so many birds and even insects have mastered. But there is one thing we're really good at, walking. As a regular human, I'm a regular human, not even particularly athletic, and I can walk 2,660 miles through the wilderness in 5 months. So can other humans, as demonstrated by the hundreds of people, many of them not so particularly athletic, who through hike the trail each year. You know who cannot do this? Dogs. Also horses. Aside from the rare exception, walking 12 hours a day, day after day, for months at a time is too much for a dog or a horse. That's just not how these animals, and many animals for that matter, exercise. Dogs like to run around, wear themselves out, and then go to sleep. Sprinting and napping. That's just how they do. Humans, on the other hand, are awake 16 hours a day, and during this time we can walk slowly forward, endlessly. This long distance walking is a weird talent, but it's one that is uniquely ours. It's a nice article. She goes on to talk about being a woman and how it struck her that women are just as good at this as men. But obviously what I liked and what jumped out at me is her that sense of that you really get into your body in a very physical way. There's something about just being out walking in nature. I can't recommend it enough as a supplement to your life. So, thank you.